Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In a few moments, we're going to talk about Frontline's new documentary, Policing the Police 2020. Well, 2020 has been a reckoning as America wrestles with systemic racism. Things like reducing incarceration, recidivism, and racial bias training are topics of common conversation, but those topics are often divisive. Can things like the titles that we use for movements focused on change and policing get in the way of the actual substance of the movements and what we're all trying to accomplish? Terry Liggins is the founder of the Hurdle Life Foundation. And before we get to Frontline's new documentary, he joins us today with more. Hey, Terry, welcome back.
Hey, Lori. Thanks for having me back. Really excited to be here.
How have you been?
Doing good. Still busy. A lot of, things to work through with the climate of our country, but I'm excited to be back in Sioux Falls. I actually took some time away out in Salt Lake City and spent a week at this amazing vocational academy for the formerly incarcerated called the Other Side Academy, and I come back deeply inspired, ready to lead and invite change here in South Dakota.
You know, you mentioned Salt Lake City, and that's interesting because Jelani Cobb, who's going to be on in a few minutes in this Frontline feature, talks about how this event of the killing of George Floyd by police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis caused this ripple effect throughout the nation, including burning cop cars in Salt Lake City. So it was so nationally, everyone's paying attention to it, certainly partially because of the pandemic and people being out of work and people being hyper-focused. But there's a whole lot going on. And then this time in 2020, slightly different from years before, we start hearing these calls to defund the police, abolish the police, what we feel about police officers. And I'm just wondering, as you sit and look back at the greater context of this through your personal experience and your coaching work and your leadership work, why now? Mm-hmm. Why was this the year that all of this kind of opened up and became something that we're still talking about?
Yeah, I think what happens too, and I think about when people finally look at their addiction in a different way, when people finally look at other behaviors in a different way, even a personal story of my mother and her recovery and sobriety. I remember she says, Terry, I got sick and tired of being sick and tired. Another said differently is enough is enough. I mean, we have been dealing with the feeling of oppression and being marginalized and harassed and targeted it for so many years. And for some of us, our entire life. I'm 35 years old and I have very limited experience with feeling affirmed or protected by law enforcement as a black male in America. And 2020 is just enough is enough. And I think there's a lot of people, black and white, that says enough is enough, and we're going to make enough noise where you realize that we're ready for the tide to turn. The time for change is now. Enough is enough. We're sick and tired of being sick and tired.
When we talk about the words public safety in this Frontline piece, one of the things that is brought to the forefront is public safety means something different to white America than it does to black America, with the idea of black people have never felt safe, or how rare it is for black people to feel safe. Like, what is your definition of safety, and sort of bringing that that word up. So I want to talk with you a little bit about these words like public safety or policing the police or defunding the police or abolishing the police. How do you think the language that we use is sort of exposing the divisions and the challenges? Are there places where it's helping us come together? How do we talk about this, and why does it matter?
It certainly matters, because what we're working to do together is change the culture. We're looking to change the culture of community corrections. We're looking to change the culture of law enforcement, of judicial precedent. We're looking to change the culture of what it means to be community. And whenever you look at culture change, you look at different aspects of culture, like food, like music, like language. Language is a big part of changing culture. So that's one of the things that really concerns me as an educator, is some of the language we're using in this attempt for change and unity and coming together. If you are trauma informed and you recognize how trauma works, then you know that the brain and the body will react a certain type of way to intimidation, fear, and threat. Whenever anybody, any human being is faced with intimidation, fear, or threat, their body biologically will respond with fight, flight, or freeze. So for me, Lori, I don't subscribe to using extreme language that says we're going to eliminate anyone or anything. So I'm very cautious and concerned about the language that's so loaded with abolishment or policing the police. Like, those types of things for me, when I look at culture, are concerning for me. And I raise the awareness for that with my other colleagues as we're looking to have healthy dialogue, looking to have healthy conversation. We got to realize we're all human beings here. We're all wanting to sustain ourselves and our livelihood, and threatening the extermination of anyone or anything. The science of trauma will tell you what you're going to get in response is someone ready to fight you, someone ready to flee, or someone raising to freeze up. And that's not how we do the work together.
What are some of the ways that we do the work together? Because one of the frustrations in communities is we need to get beyond just a conversation and we need to get to action. Mm-hmm. Other mm-hmm. communities are saying, you know, we want to do the right thing, but also people are getting shot, and we can't accept that as an alternative mm-hmm. To have no law and order, in quotation marks there. Mm-hmm. How do we get beyond just, you know, acknowledging there's a problem and saying we need to do something? Although, I don't know, Terry, are we even at acknowledging the problem? I don't know. In Sioux Falls, if we're there, if we've acknowledged as this in this community or in this state that there is a problem.
Yeah. For me, when I think about the work, I think about the power of invitation. And I think about inviting people to action, that it isn't just about having a dialogue. It is about working together to talk about what are the next steps. What type of things are we going to do differently than we've done before? As a reformer and a person who is here to educate and invite change in justice reform, I don't prescribe to the language of the system is broken. I don't talk with the warden or the chief of police or any judges and with a critical lens to say the system is broken. What I say is that there's gaps in the system. There, if we can agree that there are gaps in our justice system, yes, then let's talk together and collaborate on how to fill the gaps in the justice system. There's two different vantage points with that. It's the same end goal, two different languages. One is neutral, objective, and safe. The other one is adversarial. And I just think we got to come to the table not as adversaries, as allies, realizing there's great value in having law enforcement. There's great value in having our penal system. But if we can say there's gaps, if we can look at our outcomes and say we aren't collectively satisfied with 66% of the formerly incarcerated going back to prison within 3 years of their release, then let's together acknowledge that problem, talk about the gaps, and come up with solutions to fill the gaps.
I want to weave a couple topics in together here, but first, can you tell me a little bit about this upcoming conference that you're the keynote speaker at that is talking about community response to child abuse? Tell me a little bit about that, and then I think we can make a connection between these, you know, communities in trauma and policing.
Yeah, so this month, September 30th and October 1st, is the 20th annual Community Response to Child Abuse Conference. This conference has been happening in our community for 2 decades, and it's a collaborative effort between Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment, Unified Judicial Systems, Sanford's Children's Voice, and a lot of social service and advocacy organizations that are really looking to do the prevention work. One of the things about the justice system is also having that focus on prevention. If we can limit the interaction of young people and their parents into the system through prevention work, that's part of the work, so that we can go upstream. So every year, this group puts together this conference. I'm having the opportunity to be one of the breakout speakers, where I'm actually going to talk about the importance of trauma-informed reform and community care. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'll speak on the first, October 1st, on the second day of the 2-day conference. Registration is open now.
Let's talk about trauma-informed reform, because again, in this as Frontline, which I've seen the screener, and other people are going to be able to see tonight on SDPB TV and on the PBS app, there is a whole section, Terry, about this idea of people in a community where there is high crime that he's visiting in Newark, New Jersey, and what they have been through the generations. You know, my father was shot, my grandfather was shot, you know, I was shot. How many people had been shot? We see this in South Dakota, you know, in missing and murder indigenous women conversations we've had. Just when you go and you talk to these women, my mother was raped, my auntie was missing, you know, my cousin was killed. Let's talk about what that kind of trauma, whether it's colonization, police brutality, poverty, violence, what kind of impact does trauma have on a community?
The thing is, when you start to really understand adverse childhood experiences, trauma-informed care, and even go beyond to start looking at intergenerational trauma and how it's inherited or transposed through epigenetics and other sciences, you come to realize and recognize that people are behaving in a way not by choice but by condition, that the environment has informed how they perceive the world. And one of the things that comes through in this intergenerational trauma is fear and lack of trust. And when we accept that this is the science of trauma, that this next generation has inherited a fear of white people, a fear of law enforcement. Now talk about Native Americans and black Americans, when inherently that's a reality for that generation. A lot of black children, adults fear law enforcement because it was just inherited through the environment. Same thing with Native Americans, with white people. And so as we recognize that is not a choice but a condition, we can then now be mindful of that, be empathetic and compassionate towards that, and work on building the trust, work on eliminating the fear, not calling out the behavior as the problem. Science tells us intergenerational trauma has informed this fear and lack of trust. So how can we start to build bridges for trust and eliminating the perception of fear as the work that we're doing? And where we go wrong, Lori, is when people think that the fear is fabricated, when people don't think black Americans have a reason to be afraid of law enforcement. People constantly question, well, why was he running away? Or what else was he doing? They are not taking into mind the trauma-informed understanding that says, by default, I'm afraid. The moment I see a law enforcement officer, by default, I do not trust a white person. The moment I see a white person. And so when we continue to do this work of understanding trauma, we will then start to be more humane with each other in doing the empathetic and compassionate work of dealing with the core, not just the cause.
Are there places where you are optimistic about 2020 and what we know now, what we're paying attention to? Because I think there's a moment where many white people, let's say, broadly speaking, people who were not paying attention before, who are paying attention now, and who are now overwhelmed with everything that they're seeing, and they're seeing it for the first time, alongside people who have been living this reality and living this experience for decades. That's a lot happening in sort of the cultural soup that we're living. Where do you see hope in that instead of just is it an awakening or a reckoning? Like where is the hope lie?
Yeah, and I can hear the weight you're wrestling with on this, Lori, because this is a deep-rooted issue, and there's people like you and I that are looking to shine a light on these things and to help people to feel more comfortable with this work. And it is tough to have hope. And for me, I just boil it down to each individual. I have to just think about each one, reaching one, teaching one, that one to another, that we can continue to build a collective momentum. Because when I look at the state of our government, even at the national or the state level, and I look at the system, it is hard to feel hopeful. I mean, my hope is not in this system. My hope is in each and every individual having an open mind and an open heart to listen, to seek to understand, to work, to just be civil to one another. This is a civil rights movement. This is a human rights movement. And there are some realities within civil rights and human rights that we should honor. And racial disparity is one of those things. Things like poverty and addiction, the reality of those things, that's a part of it. And my hope is in that each and every individual taking an honest evaluation at themselves and saying, am I part of the problem or am I a part of the solution? And inaction and silence is no longer acceptable. So if you're not engaged, you're part of the problem. So let's get engaged through whatever means that is, a civic engagement, reading and book clubs, dialogue. But I am hopeful that small businesses, entrepreneurs, organizations, the small business community, I was just asked this question. We're coming together. We're opening our doors. We're trying to be broader and take the mantle upon ourselves as community. If we continue to think that this issue is going to be solved by pointing outward at courts and cops and corrections and not look at the responsibility we have as a community, we're missing that fourth wheel to the administration of justice, which is community. So I'm hopeful in community response to the administration of justice.
Terry Liggins is the founder of the Hurdle Life Foundation, and he's the keynote speaker for the September 30th and October 1st Community Response to Child Abuse Conference. You can register for that now online. Terry, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you next time.
Absolutely.